Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello everyone and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. The passing of the Queen in September has encouraged us historians to shine a light on the era of her reign, the 70 years between 1952 and 2022, an extraordinary period in which the world has fundamentally changed several times over. Now, one way to look at it is through the experience of the Royal Navy, and it's quite a story. Throughout her reign, the Royal Navy didn't just change, as you might suspect. It changed beyond all recognition. In 1952, the UK was still a global and maritime superpower with a large empire. It had the second largest navy, the largest shipbuilding industry, and the largest merchant fleet in the world. The vast networks of seaborne trade routes were policed by a navy of a size and versatility that was able to engage independently in most foreseeable types of conflict. Today, the UK's superpower role is much diminished, and its empire has gone. The nation's shipbuilding industry and merchant fleet are shadows of their former selves. And this change all happened in the shadows of the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Falklands War, the Cod Wars, just to name a few of the significant international maritime events of the time. So much has changed, but the Royal Navy finds itself today with the challenge of exercising its power in a way entirely unforeseen in the 1950s. To find out more, I spoke with the maritime historian Paul Brown, author of Elizabeth's Navy, 70 Years of the Post-War Royal Navy. Paul is a member of the Society for Nautical Research and the Britannia Naval Research Association. He has also been Secretary of the Naval Dockyard Society and a consultant to National Historic Ships, the UK's authority on the preservation of historic ships and boats. I hope you enjoy listening to him as much as I enjoy talking with him. Here is the deeply knowledgeable and thoroughly engaging Paul. Paul, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
Thanks, Sam. It's a pleasure.
Now, it's a fascinating topic, this. I'm much more interested in it than I thought I was going to be. I thought it was just going to be 70 years of depression and things going wrong and navies getting smaller.
But there's quite actually a bit of that.
There is quite a bit of that, but it also there is so much fascinating history here. Let's start with the 1950s. Paint us a picture of what's going on here with the UK still being a global maritime superpower.
Well, that's right. 1952, the start of Elizabeth's reign. We were the second biggest navy in the world after the United States, having been overhauled by them in the Second World War. And we still had a worldwide presence. I mean, there was the big home fleet, Mediterranean fleet. Then there were squadrons in the South Atlantic, the West Indies, the Middle East, and the Far East. Britain, of course, was still the largest, had the world's largest shipbuilding industry and the world's largest merchant fleet. So part of the Navy's role was traditionally protecting those trade routes. So we had a big navy. we had 328 major ships, and I'll use that term for anything of frigate size or submarine size or bigger. So we had 328 ships, plus about 400 smaller ships. Now, of the 328 bigger ones, 147 were in reserve. So we had a big reserve fleet.
Yeah, I was actually just looking at that, and I think this tells a real tale. So this is reserve. There are four battleships, three aircraft carriers, eight cruisers, 45 destroyers, and 113 frigates in reserve.
Right. You've got to bear in mind two things. A lot of those ships were quite modern in the sense they were built during the Second World War. So although loads of ships were scrapped at the end of the Second World War, a lot of the more modern ones were kept. So big reserve fleet. Secondly, the Cold War had started. So Russia was built, NATO had been formed in 48. Russia was building up its navy, particularly a large submarine fleet. It had 300 submarines either in service or building. So the reserve fleet was there as a contingency for all of that. So that still left about 170 major ships in service. So it was a pretty big fleet.
Yeah. My grandfather was in the Navy then, and he fought in the Cod War. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But he had, I remember we used to sit in the dining room, and there was a large oil painting of the Coronation Review. Over the we sold the painting now, which is a real shame. I'd like it over my table. But the Coronation Review was a big moment. It was a chance to really shout about this fleet, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I describe it as the last big imperial hurrah, because it was the last review at which we could line up lines of frigates, destroyers, aircraft carriers. There were six aircraft carriers present. There were eight cruisers. There were 28 destroyers, 38 frigates, 28 submarines, and lots of other smaller and miscellaneous ships. So when the Queen went down the lines in the Surprise, which was a converted frigate, the Royal Yacht Britannia was not yet complete. There was plenty to look at. There were foreign and Commonwealth warships there as well, but in predominantly the ships were British warships, and at the head of the lines was Vanguard, the last British battleship. By that time, as you mentioned, the other battleships were in reserve, but the flagship of the home fleet was Vanguard, and she was in service still, was to remain in service for another 3 years before she was paid off into reserve. And I can remember as a small boy going down to the, very small boy, going down to the beach at Stokes Bay and looking at the review of the fleet in 1953 for the illuminations and fireworks display in the evening. And I don't remember seeing it in daylight, although I probably did, but that view of everything in the evening with the firework display and so on left a big impression on me.
Yeah. Such a kind of powerful start to this period, isn't it? Because, you know, if you then jump from there to where we are now, it's so striking, the loss of ships. Let's just talk a little bit about what was happening in the 1950s. The Korean War was a significant moment. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Korean War had started in 1950, so, and lasted till 53, when North Korea, with the backing of China and Russia, invaded South Korea, and the United Nations mobilized, through the United Nations resolution, an allied fleet of American, British, and there were about 19 different nations involved, I think, was put together. And the role of the Navy was probably twofold, with the aircraft carriers launching strike raids on the North Korean forces and infrastructure, and also keeping the coastal waters clear of North Korean warships and supply ships and so on. So the Navy had a big presence there during that time, and it patrolled the west coast of Korea. The Royal Navy had the main role of dealing with the west coast of Korea, whereas the Yanks were on the other side. And our aircraft carriers were heavily involved. HMS Ocean, for example, flew nearly 8,000 sorties.
Wow.
And several other aircraft carriers did similar things. And aircraft from Ocean shot down at least one MiG jet, which was the only known occasion when a piston engine aircraft had shot down a jet aircraft. HMS Belfast fired over 8,000 six-inch shells when she was bombarding. That was another aspect of it, bombardment of the shore by ships like Belfast and the other cruisers that were lying offshore. And the Korean War was seen as a kind of surrogate for the wider Cold War because of China and Russia being involved in backing North Korea. And the Royal Navy, or the UK government, persuaded by the Royal Navy, no doubt, woke up to the fact that we were going to need to modernise the Navy and build more ships, because there was a complete suspension after the Second World War of building new warships. And so in 1951, orders were placed for 6 porpoise-class submarines, 27 frigates of 4 different classes, 116 coastal minesweepers and over 70 inshore minesweepers, because one of the big threats that was perceived was that the Soviets would extensively mine around our ports and we would need a huge fleet of minesweepers. So nearly 200 wooden minesweepers were built in the 50s to deal with that. So it did give a spur, if you like, to the rebuilding of the Navy and building types of warships that were now going to be needed. For example, fast anti-submarine frigates. The Germans at the end of the Second World War had started to perfect the idea of fast submarines, and they'd become more or less the norm by the early 50s. And our anti-submarine ships that were used, like in the north, defending the North Atlantic convoys and so on in the Second World War, were much too slow to deal with them. So we needed a whole new force of anti-submarine frigates to counter the Soviet threat from its rapidly building submarine force. Now, one way of doing that was to convert fast destroyers that had been built in the war, still quite new, into frigates, and over 30 of those were converted. But we also had to start building new fast anti-submarine frigates with the Whitby class, for example.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the Cod War, because that's radically different to what was going on in Korea. And it's, I think it's a fascinating episode. I'd like to know a bit more about it. And we should say that the Cod War, it was a term coined by a journalist in 1958, I think. So it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. It wasn't a real war, or it was more of a kind of a dispute. Tell us about the Cod War.
Well, it was, as you say, 1958, the first of 3 Cod Wars. At that time, we had massive trawler fleets in places like Hull and Grimsby. And one of their prime fishing areas was off the coast of Iceland. And Iceland declared a big extension to its territorial waters.
Yeah, just kind of, was that out of the blue? It's an extraordinary thing. It's like suddenly they've decided that they had more water than everyone else thought they had.
Yeah, it was. We, of course, resisted that, and they started ramming our trawlers with their smaller, their gunboats and patrol vessels. They only had a small navy, but they caused havoc to our trawlers, and so the Navy had to send in frigates, but some of the large ocean minesweepers that we had then, and so on, to help protect those trawlers. And as happened with the next two Cod Wars, because the same happened in the early 70s, there were 2 more Cod Wars, these vessels, our frigates, were quite often involved in collisions with the Icelandic gunboats as they warded them off. But the trouble was Iceland held a sort of an ace hand because that it was a NATO base for America in particular, and they threatened to withdraw from NATO if we didn't recognise their new territorial limits. So progressively, between 1958 and, I don't know, when it was about 1976, there was more and more recognition and wider territorial waters for Iceland, which of course ended up with the abolition almost of our deep sea trawler fleet, because it just wasn't economic for them. They'd lost their prime fishing grounds.
Yeah, it's a seriously astute move by the Icelanders, isn't it? It's quite impressive. I'd like to know who was behind that, who suddenly clocked that if they allow the Americans to land their bombers or whatever was going on in Iceland, then they could take more of the world's seas for themselves. 1960s, things change. We've got a major economic downturn, and this seems to be the moment that the wheels start coming off for the Navy.
Yeah, I mean, in the early 60s and most of the 60s, we still maintained that worldwide presence of the Navy. But the economic situation and the decline, of course, of the empire, many of those areas were gaining independence, meant that the Navy was going to have to change its role radically. And in the late 60s, the Labour government decided to withdraw from east of Suez and also to run down the aircraft carrier fleet, which was primarily serving east of Suez. So, and that all took effect by about 1971. We also lost our presence in the South Atlantic. We carried on, apart from the famous ice patrol ship in the Falklands area, we had to have some presence in the Caribbean because of our possessions there. And also we kept some presence in the Gulf, the Arabian Gulf and the Middle East, because basically that was the one trade route we had to protect because of oil. So the Far East fleet, which had become the biggest fleet in the Navy, had supplanted the Mediterranean Navy, and that was run down completely. I mean, there had been a big build-up of the Far East fleet in the early 60s because of the Indonesian confrontation. This was when the Federation of Malaya gained independence and incorporated one or two other states like North Borneo and Sarawak to become Malaysia. And President Sukarno in Indonesia didn't like the idea of this, particularly North Borneo, which he wanted to incorporate into Indonesia. And so there was a lot of infiltration of Indonesians into North Borneo in particular. So for 2 or 3 years, there was a huge build-up of the Far East fleet to deal with that situation and suppress all of that Indonesian activity. So by the end of the 60s, all of that was long past, and the aircraft carriers were going to be a thing of the past, as was the Far East fleet.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah. The advent of Polaris is an interesting stage in this, isn't it? So early 60s, when you suddenly have nuclear-armed submarine-launched ballistic missiles. Tell us about how that affected things.
Well, the RAF's V-bomber force was ageing and had to be replaced. And one or two suggested replacements failed to materialise. And of course, the Americans had already got, by this time, ballistic missile armed with nuclear warhead submarines. The latest development was Polaris, as you say, missiles. And this was through agreement, I think originally between Macmillan and Kennedy, it was agreed that the British could acquire the Polaris missiles. We would make the warheads and the submarines. Mm. The Americans would supply the missiles themselves. The big advantage of these submarines was that they could not be easily detected, and therefore they could be a deterrent, because any nuclear strike, we could retaliate, because it couldn't strike at our submarines, ballistic missile submarines. Whereas a V-bomber base could be attacked, the whole key to the ballistic missile submarines, the Polaris submarines, was that the Russians should never know where they are when they're on patrol. So four of those Resolution class Polaris submarines were built, and it was intended and indeed achieved that one of them at least would always be on deterrent patrol somewhere unknown, but within range of, at that time, of course, all the key cities in Russia and Soviet Union. And to this day, that independent deterrent, nuclear deterrent role is still held by the Navy, of course, with Trident submarines. And their boast is that they have never had to suspend a patrol. That patrol has been continuous since 1968, when the first Polaris submarine went on patrol.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. So you've got all of this going on around the coast of Russia, around the North Sea, I suppose. But then 1980s, we have the problem of the Falklands. Tell us in brief about what was going on there.
Yeah, well, the Falklands War was in the whole of this 70 years, although the Cold War was the dominant force affecting our defence forces, the Falklands was the biggest actual conflict. And of course, the government, the military junta of Argentina, had orchestrated an invasion of the Falkland Islands. There'd been claims over its sovereignty by them for many years, and nobody ever really thought it would come to this, although the Navy did have plans for such a contingency. And the Navy saw this as their big moment to particularly as a big defence review had been particularly savage with its cuts to the Royal Navy in 1981. Here was a chance in 1982 to salvage something in terms of their reputation and their size and their number of ships. And so the then First Sea Lord told Margaret Thatcher, yes, we could mount a task force which could reclaim the Falklands, even though they were 8,000 miles away without any bases anywhere near them. So there were huge logistics issues and so on in supplying that task force, which went down and, of course, as we know, successfully retook the islands through amphibious landings. The biggest threat it had to face was the Argentine Air Force and the Navy's Argentine Navy's fleet air arm, with something like 200 strike aircraft up against our 24 Sea Harriers. So that was a real contest, and sadly, as we know, six British ships were lost in the conflict. Many lives were lost, but it did demonstrate. Out of it came a lot of lessons, really, because it was the first time nuclear submarines had been used in combat. Guided missiles, for the first time, had been used in combat, and so on. So a lot of the new weaponry that had developed since World War II was being tested out. So many lessons came out about what needed to be done to our ships, our aircraft, and so on, to face the kind of threats that they would meet from modern weapon systems.
Yeah, it's a fascinating period, and I'd urge everyone to listen to your previous podcast where we talked about that in more detail. 1990s, so the key thing here is the end of the Soviet Union, a very important moment and a period. How did that affect the Navy?
Well, what was declared was the so-called peace dividend. You know, we wouldn't need all these ships, all these submarines, all these sailors, because Russia, well, Soviet Union, soon to become Russia only, really, was in meltdown. Many of its ships were being laid up. They had big economic problems. They couldn't repair, maintain their ships. So having said that, whilst it was said to be the end of the Cold War, that didn't mean the Russians stopped deploying their submarines with nuclear missiles, just like we had Polaris still at that time. But it did mean the government was able to take the opportunity, if you like, to run down the size of the fleet. I mean, the spending on defence had been 11% of GDP in 1952. It ran down to, after the peace dividend, ran down to 2.5%. During the latter part of the Cold War, it had been around 5 to 7%. So we were halving our expenditure on defence. Quite a few nuclear submarines, and the last of the conventional diesel submarines were paid off, as were quite a lot of frigates. So it didn't all happen overnight, because it's been a history of continuous salami slicing. But certainly in the early 90s, we saw some of the biggest reductions.
Yeah. And the 2000s is interesting, with, again, different challenges, primarily Iraq and Afghanistan. Tell us a little about how the Navy fitted into that complicated jigsaw.
Again, in the 2000s, there were big defence cuts. I remember just around at the time of the big fleet review at Spithead in 2005, quite a few ships were being paid off. There was the so-called war on terror going on in the Middle East after the so-called Second Gulf War, and then the Afghanistan campaign, where we, through again amphibious landings, we landed troops in Helmand Province, and Royal Marines were amongst those, part of the Navy, of course, who had to take that ground and keep it. And in fact, the last Royal Marines didn't leave Afghanistan till 2014. So it was a very protracted campaign. The Navy had a role as well. Our submarines were launching Tomahawk cruise missiles at various land targets, as they had done in some of the other more recent conflicts. So really, I think that decade was probably dominated by the Middle East invasion of Iraq, and then the attempt to beat the Taliban in Afghanistan and remove the threat through the so-called war on terror, which we know didn't end well. The Taliban still ended up regaining control of Afghanistan.
And then, you know, thinking about what's happening in the present day and responding to the growing threat of China, how is the Royal Navy trying to deal with that?
Well, things have moved on slightly, even from what I've got in my book. It's one of the troubles of writing about current events. But basically, the Navy decided a couple of years ago that it would re-establish that presence in the Indo-Pacific region. And they sent two new patrol ships out there. Now, that wasn't really going to put the frighteners on the Chinese too much, I don't think. And those, they're permanently forward deployed there with a roving brief, but over a massive area of the Indo-Pacific. And then last year, we had the first task force deployment to the Far East. All of this is to counter the perceived threat from China, which has been building up its armed forces dramatically, as of course has Russia since 2008. And now we're beginning to see even more of a coalition between Russia and China emerging, as we know. But anyway, that large task force, a seven-month deployment led by HMS Queen Elizabeth, one of the two aircraft carriers, went with a whole group of escorts and submarines out as far as the South China Sea and back as a demonstration, if you like, of our capability to still mount that kind of thing. So all of this, if the latest update on that, of course, is that we intend to base one of our Astute-class nuclear submarines in Australia and share duties there with American submarines. Also with the French, because the French aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle and our two aircraft carriers will share on rotation basis the mounting of, again, task force deployments to the Far East. So whilst we won't have quite anything like the same permanent presence we used to have, we are developing a capability and more presence in the Far East.
Yeah, let's end by just talking about the autonomous mine hunting and mine sweeping launches which are being built now, because that takes us back to what you were saying in the 1950s with all the money being spent on mine sweeping. I think this is a fascinating development, and tell us about the Royal Navy's interest in autonomous craft.
Well, it's part of a more general trend, if you like, towards autonomous systems. Mine hunters have had a lot of the publicity, so instead of having expensive mine hunters like the current Brecon and Sandown classes, we will have small launches which are autonomous, unmanned, to deal with mines. And this is happening in so many areas now that unmanned submersibles, for example, are coming into play. And we've already got this mine hunting capability being extended now into the Middle East, where we've always had mine hunters. One of the disadvantages is the old mine hunters could carry out other roles as patrol vessels, for example. So when they're gone, we lose yet more surface units in the Navy, which can take on a multiplicity of roles.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating to see how it's going to develop, if a little concerning, because I'm not entirely sure we've got enough vessels to protect our aircraft carriers or protect our nuclear subs.
Well, that's part of the problem. In one sense, we have a balanced fleet, so you could say that's a positive, because we maintain aircraft carriers, nuclear submarines, strategic deterrent, even still an amphibious warfare force. But that then means it's maybe balanced, but it's also spread very thinly. And we haven't got enough nuclear submarines and escorts, i.e. destroyers and frigates, to support and defend our aircraft carriers. We also haven't got enough aircraft for the aircraft carriers. At any one time, only one of the two has F-35B Lightning jets on it. And even there, not enough. They should be carrying something like 24. When the Queen Elizabeth deployed to the Far East, she only had 8 plus 10 American ones. So whilst the investment in the two aircraft carriers has been impressive, a lot of aspects of the Navy that are needed to support it and to complement that role aren't really present.
Well, really, really interesting topic. Paul, thank you very much indeed for sharing it with us today.
Thanks very much, sir.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, if you're interested in such contemporary issues that have been highlighted here, then please do check out a podcast I recorded in September 2021, in which I was invited to Portsmouth to interview the First Sea Lord, who speaks in great detail about the challenges that the Navy currently faces. A subsequent episode explored the question, is Britain still a global power? Which is also well worth listening to. Please also check out our fabulous YouTube channels, a host of videos. I should probably say a fleet or fleets of videos exploring our maritime past. We're currently working on animating one of those brilliant cutaway drawings of a ship that shows all the goings on inside. You all know what I mean. You've seen them in countless maritime history books and online. But this is not a modern phenomenon. In fact, we've started with a very famous image from the late 17th century of a first-rate warship. It's going to be fantastic. So that'll be coming soon on the Mariner's Mirror podcast's YouTube channel, but there's tons of other material for you to spend several happy hours watching. In fact, it's all so good that recently the monthly viewing figures for our YouTube channel have exceeded our listening figures for the podcast. This podcast comes from both the Society for Nautical Research and the Lloyd's Register Foundation, and please do check out what both of those brilliant institutions are doing. In particular, please check out the Lloyd's Register Foundation's latest project, Maritime Innovation in Miniature, in which they're filming the world's best ship models using the latest camera technology. It's truly fantastic. To find it, just Google Maritime Innovation in Miniature. That's Maritime Innovation in Miniature. And please join the Society for Nautical Research. You can find them at snr.org.uk. It's a wonderful way to meet people and to find out about the maritime past from the very best scholars in the field.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.